Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, we've been doing this for a little bit now, but we haven't spent that much time talking about what's basically the hottest trend in ETFs, which is smart beta.
Yeah, it's one of them. I think people forget that smart beta is 20% of ETF assets, so it's a big chunk. The other 80% virtually is all what we call cheap beta, which is, you know, the S&P 500 ETF, and we call it the plain vanilla side. But this 20% is up from nothing 10 years ago. So it is it's growing faster on a percentage basis than ETFs as a whole. And it's a really interesting dynamic area. This is where a lot of the innovation and new products are being launched.
So how are we supposed to think about this thing called smart beta?
Well, it can be confusing. A lot of times people think it sounds like something you get at the GNC store.
Yeah, I mean,
right? I know
whey container, little double chocolate smart beta.
It's definitely jargony, and it's got a buzzword type feel to it. But, you know, essentially, a lot of people will give you different definitions of it. To me, you know, the metaphor I use is the way people describe different religions, right? There's this thing that they say it's like a bunch of people touching an elephant in a dark room in the way different religions describing God. It's the same thing, mm-hmm. but it's just being they're feeling a different part of it, but ultimately it's the same thing. To me, smart beta.
What am I touching right now? What is that? I'm in a dark room.
You don't want to know.
Okay, all right.
No, let's say you're touching the trunk, somebody else is touching the side. My point is that smart beta kind of can mean different things to different people. It's controversial. And I think that a lot of people, instead of thinking you need to like capture it and be done with understanding it in 2 seconds, I think you need to just accept that it's a little bit of a mystery to some people. There's a complexity to it and there's differing opinions. As long as you embrace that and sort of go into this conversation we're about to have knowing that you're going to understand a little more, I think that's the way to go. You got to lower the bar on this because you can't really just get it done in like 2 or 3 sentences.
If I had to do it in one sentence, how would you describe it?
I would say smart beta is trying to take Peter Lynch's brain and put it into R2-D2.
That's an amazing
Just
mashup.
Just think about that.
That's an amazing mashup.
In other words, you're trying to take the best of active management, but putting it into a rules-based index that an ETF tracks. So it's basically a conversion of active and trying to make it better and more efficient and cheaper and deliver it in a better structure.
This week on Trillions, the mystery of smart beta. Okay, Eric, we've got some guests. This is really important because I think every one of these guests, including you and me, will have a different perspective on smart beta. So we're all sort of touching the elephant in your dark room, your creepy dark room filled with an elephant and us.
Yeah, it's almost akin to when you go to a conference, an ETF conference, there's a panel. You tend to have people from different lenses. So we're trying to sort of capture that so that you can get all of the viewpoints and then you can sort of come up with your own sort of view on it.
One of them's remote, so he's in his own dark room touching a different elephant. Nir Kesar, a columnist with Bloomberg Gadfly. Hi, Nir.
Hello.
He's in D.C. Joining us in the booth is Tom Serafagas, who is a colleague of yours at Bloomberg Intelligence, where he's an ETF analyst. Also came from Oppenheimer before he was at Bloomberg and has some experience with smart beta ETFs.
Yeah, I do.
Hi, Tom.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining. So, Tom, can you help start this discussion around what is smart beta? Let's define it so that it, you know, before people get in the deep end of the pool with us, we have an understanding of what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. And so before I joined here, I was at on the other side of the table, so on the issuer side. And you have to remember that a lot of these active shops have a tremendous amount of resources, right? They've got portfolio managers and analysts. So I think in a very brief way, what they were trying to do is take the mind of the portfolio manager. Peter Lynch or someone else, saying, hey, when you're picking stocks, what are things you're looking at? Mm-hmm. How are you running your screens? Mm-hmm. What are you looking at? Let's take your approach, write it down, put it in an index, and launch an ETF over it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the definition of smart beta, it's not so clear, right? It's a very gray area, but it's really trying to take a lot of these approaches, democratize it, put it in an ETF, and make it available to the masses.
As a product.
As a product.
You can buy off the shelf, right?
Yep.
Nir, how do you think about it?
I think those are both good. Both Eric and Tom's definitions, I think, are both good. I'll just try to simplify it even further, because I think it's really important to convey to investors that this is actually very simple in concept. All this is traditional active management. All the strategies that they've always loved and have been used for decades by every active manager ever. Value, you know, buying cheaper companies, buying, you know, high growth companies, buying smaller companies, whatever the strategy that you like is, effectively giving it to a computer and letting a computer run it. That's really all it is. And the reason that's important to convey is the act of taking it away from the human and giving it to the computer gives the investor several advantages that are really important. One, it makes it a lot cheaper because you can, you know, the computer doesn't cost as much as the human. That's the first thing.
We tend to like that.
That's, you know, that's a good thing. The second thing is they're more transparent. Because you've turned it over to a computer, you've had to write rules about how this thing will look. And investors can read these rules and they can see exactly what they're buying. So that's useful too. And the other thing is it allows us to fine tune how we think about these various styles. So for example, me and you, we might both like value, right? But you might like it more than me. So I can write a computer program for you that gives you more value and less value for me and so on. And these are things that are more difficult to do with human beings. So that's all it is.
That sounds simple.
Yeah, let me add in here to dovetail to my original definition and just go in how the term came about, because this probably will help. A consulting firm named Towers Watson is who coined the phrase smart beta. And this is exactly how they defined it in their literature in year 2000. Smart beta is simply about trying to identify good investment ideas that can be structured better. So think about it. What do people not like about an active mutual fund? They're high cost. The manager could be emotional and make decisions based on like the current trends. And they have distribute capital gains regardless of whether you – even if you stayed invested, you got tax bill. Now, if you take that active mutual fund strategy and you put it into a rules-based index, you essentially eliminate the emotion, right, because it's going to rebalance and be
– it's a robot.
Like you said, it's a robot. You're going to lower the fee because there's less overhead in the ETF structure. So usually like a third as cheap as – or a third as expensive as an active mutual fund. And their ETFs are very tax efficient. So you can have some decent turnover inside the fund and yet no capital gains get distributed. So you eliminate three of the baggage of the active mutual fund when you cross it over. So in a way, Towers Watson definition is true. It's just been mutated over the years and pissed people off because they think that it means smart means better. And it's not necessarily better. It's better a better way to deliver something, not you're going to definitely outperform.
And let's be clear, there's also different names for smart beta. It's not like smart beta is the only one, right, Tom? Like what other terms can mean smart beta?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of terminology that's been thrown out. People call it strategic beta, alternative beta, active beta. You know, and a lot of people will get caught up in the semantics because they think that, oh, if it's not smart beta, it's dumb beta, right? It's not so binary that it's just one or the other. So a lot of people tend to get caught up in the semantics and kind of forget, like, what is the bigger theme here? Like, what are these products giving you? What are they offering you?
Can you help me embrace the complicated a little bit here? Because one of the main differences with smart beta is with a normal ETF, the most popular ones, the plain vanilla ones, those are all market cap weighted, right? So help me better understand what sometimes the difference is with smart beta.
Right. Well, in the Towers Watson definition, they would call all that bulk beta. So there's just two. Bulk beta, which is market cap weighted. This, I think a lot of people would just call beta.
Just tell me what market cap is, right? Like that's
right. So the S&P 500, the bigger the stock's market cap, the bigger the weighting, right? So as stocks get bigger, so the top weightings in the S&P are Apple, Microsoft.
Amazon.
Right.
Yep.
You got it. Now, that is another way to view smart beta and how some people do it. If you are in the index fund world or the Vanguard world and you're used to market cap weighted products, which are very popular, smart beta to you seems like a mutation or a twist on the market cap weighting structure. So you could actually view smart beta from that lens and either look at it as a way to try to like do better than the market cap weighted index, because you're going to change the way the index works. You're going to maybe weight by dividends instead of market cap. You're going to weight by size. You could weight by a collection of fundamentals. That is another way to view it. So you can see smart beta from the active side or from the passive side and describe it different ways.
But that sounds kind of controversial, right?
Well, it is. The word smart is the controversial part. But I equate it to Obamacare, right? Remember what was the real name of the bill? I don't even remember. The Patient and Affordable Care
Act. Good branding right there.
Right. So even Obama started calling it Obamacare. Smart beta is just a buzzword that you cannot beat down. People have come along, like Tom said. Morningstar tries to call it strategic beta, scientific beta, alternative beta, quantamental indexes. How about that one? Anti-benchmark is the France calls it that. Active beta, as you said.
You just keep coming back to smart beta. Smart beta sticks.
It sticks. But the word smart is what has made it controversial because at the end of the day, you may or may not outperform. You're just going to have a different return stream than a market cap weighted index.
Okay, Eric, can we actually break this thing down and talk about smart beta in real life? Let's call it a case study. Do you have an example of a smart beta ETF? And can you walk me through how it did what it did?
Right. So here's a classic one. Came out in 2005. So this is like early settler smart beta product, right? This was the PowerShares FTSE.
I can picture it out in the homestead.
Back then it was a lot of open frontier.
Yeah.
People put flags everywhere now. That's why the ETF landscape is very crowded, hard to come up with new ideas. There's not much white space left, so to speak. But this really was one of the first ones. It's the PowerShares FTSE RAFI US 1000 portfolio, ticker PRF.
Can you say that again?
No. Here's what it does. It's pretty simple. It tracks stocks based on four fundamental measures, right? Book value, cash flow, sales, and dividends. So it just screens stocks, 1,000 stocks by those metrics, comes up with a score, sorts them by that, and then every quarter it looks for which ones go to the top and then it weights them by the score. And that's how the index works, and that's what the ETF tracks. That's all it does, and it goes on like
that. It's a little robot.
It is. It's a total.
How often does it rebalance?
Quarterly. So it's almost like a robotic version of a stock analyst, right? Because it's doing things that a researcher would look for. Those are definitely popular fundamental metrics. Here's where I think this is a great example of how it works, especially on the lack of emotion side. In 2008, right, bank stocks were hated.
Financial crisis.
Nobody wanted to buy Citigroup and any of these stocks. Well, as you know, they got cheaper on a valuation basis because everybody sold them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this thing is a robot. It doesn't read the news. It doesn't know what's going on. It's not getting yelled at by clients. So it rebalanced into financials in a big way. It had 50% financials in the beginning of 2009.
So it like doubled down on it.
It doubled down. It went into the burning building, as Warren Buffett would say. Big time.
Yeah.
With a suit of gasoline.
Yeah. and on top of that, I mean, like, I assume maybe the guy in charge of this, who is whom?
So the person who made the index is Rob Arnott.
And I'm guessing Rob maybe got some heat for that.
He did. So I interviewed him for my book, and he said that institutional funds that track that index on a separate account basis called up and said, do not do the rebalance. We do not want to do this.
Override. Don't let the robot do this.
Exactly. And in a separate account, you can do that. The ETF cannot. Well, guess who won after 5 years? Basically, that rebalance accounted for almost all of the firm's 40% outperformance over the next 5 years.
40%. Wow.
And 25% of the 40% came from the financials, that one rebalance. Now, Ben Johnson of Morningstar calls it the immaculate rebalance. He thinks that I'm bringing up a
nice
extreme situation. He also brings up that a lot of investors in the ETF left too because they couldn't handle it. And so part of smart beta, this brings up the behavior. If you really want to benefit from it and the lack of emotion, you have to hang in there. So the ETF did its job going in the burning building, but a lot of investors couldn't handle the heat either. So that's why all of that is important to point out there. But that is an example of how the smart beta can work for you and arguably be better than a human being manager.
Nir, do you have a case study that rivals Eric's?
Well, I don't know if it rivals Eric's, but it's a little bit different.
Come on, just make it rival, just for rivalry.
Okay, why not? Okay, yeah, let's get it on. There are two ETFs that I wanted to bring up that illustrate the point that I made earlier about giving you different types, different depths of exposure. So, for example, I looked at value as an active strategy, and one value ETF that
which
you can
is basically a factor, right? Like to simplify that, like value, and there are many different types of factors. Value is basically probably the most famous one, right?
Yeah, it's most famous, and for a good reason, by the way, because it works very often. I mean, in other words, if you back tested all these various types of factors, value and quality and momentum and so on, the success rate for value over rolling periods is exceedingly high. So it's very popular,
especially like over time.
That's right. And it's also intuitively appealing, right? Because it makes sense that if you buy a company that's beaten down, you should get paid more than a company that's not, right? It has intuitive appeal, and the numbers check out. So that's why it's so popular. And there are two different ETFs that you can buy that give you different types of exposure to it. One is VTV, which is the Vanguard Value ETF. And that ETF sorts stocks based on a value, and then it weights them by market cap. So that's one way that you can get value. But by contrast, you can also buy a different value ETF. That's the VLUE, which is the iShares Edge MSCI USA Value Factor ETF. Don't ask me why these names have to be this long. And the difference here is that this too sorts by value, but then it also weights by value. And so the difference is you get more value exposure in the iShares fund than you do in the Vanguard fund. Now, that doesn't make the iShares fund better, but it allows investors to express a preference as to how much value they want in their portfolio. If they want more, they go for the iShares. If they want less, they go for the Vanguard.
I would like to use a metaphor. We have this thing called the smart beta spectrum. And what Nir just described, if you could picture a spectrum, on one side you have VTV. It's got just a little bit of value. It's going to do better if the regular market's doing well because it's mostly bulk beta.
Mm-hmm.
VLUE is sort of in the middle. And the value factor in the name is important because when you see that, that means it's weighting by the factor. That's going to give you more juice. It's almost like VTV is O'Doul's. And VLUE, uh-huh. You have barely any alcohol. Yep. You have to drink like two cases to get, a buzz. The middle there is VLUE. That's going to be more like just a regular beer, like a Budweiser. But then there's even ones that go further that are more hardcore value because VLUE, and Nir probably knows this, has a volatility screen. So it's got this like screen to kick out really hardcore value stocks because – it's trying to sell it to advisors who don't want that crazy of a ride.
Mm-hmm.
But there are more pure value, like West Gray's, QVAL, the Quant shares, that are on the far end, which would be like that German beer that has like 13%.
Double hopped IPA. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think this is a fascinating development in the ETF world. And this could make smart beta confusing to people. But really what you got to figure out is how much juice or factor content, how much aggressiveness do you want in this smart beta ETF because they have all flavors.
Tom, can you give me a case study that tops Eric's?
Yeah, so mine's a little bit different in that, the example that Eric gave is more, takes the mind of the active manager and it kicks out the emotion, right? This, the product I want to talk about is a little bit more about targeting a specific outcome or helping somebody target an outcome. So let's just say you want to own the market, but you want to own it in the least volatile way. Mm-hmm. You don't want to own the riskiest stocks. So I want to bring up SPLV, which is the S&P 500 low volatility ETF by PowerShares. Is the name long enough?
I was going to say, Eric, we should do a whole episode about the longest names in ETF in the ETF world.
A new one was just filed that broke the record.
Really?
The Gabelli Pet Parent, Pet Companions and Their Parents, and Pet Ecosystems.
You're kidding
ETMF.
Me. What?
I know. There's multiple reasons why that's insanely amazing.
What's the ticker?
We don't know yet, but it's got to have five. I think it's going to be kitty or doggy, but that's a whole
that's
different
amazing.
Story. A couple ETFs Sidebar. Also have 13, 14 words in the name, but that one's long.
Okay, back to SPLV.
Sure, and why I wanted to highlight this one is because it's in a smart beta category that's gotten pretty popular. It's low volatility, right? So it's owning the market in the least volatile way. So this launched back in 2011, and if you remember what happened in the summer of 2011 was the U.S. got downgraded by the S&P. So there's a lot of market volatility. And this thing kind of got put on the map. Like, hey, it's down less than the market. So it's very simple
it
methodology.
Is the market,
it is.
Down less than the market.
And it's very simple. And I think this is why it's had some success is it takes the S&P 500 and it says, we are only going to take the 100 least volatile stocks. It's very simple, right? So you're going to own 100 least volatile stocks in the S&P. So when you look at, some big drawdowns in the S&P, it's down less, holds up a little bit better. So it's kind of maybe like a little bit of a FOMO ETF that you still want to own the market, but you want to do it in the least volatile way. And it's 25 basis points. It's been out for a while. It's gotten pretty big. It's about $6 or $7 billion in assets.
I also like that you didn't pimp a product that you used to work on. That's classy of you.
And let me talk. I want to add on to this because it's interesting. When SPLV came out, it tracks just those 100 stocks. So it has no sector. It doesn't care where. It just goes where. It ends up having typically overweight to utilities and staples, which are always usually the less volatile stocks. So some investors think, oh, well, those are more susceptible to rising rates, or they don't want to be overweight these sectors. So iShares came out with a version that has sector bands. Mm. And then there's multiple products that do a little of both. And so, but SPLV was like sort of the speaking of the frontier, that was like the first one that nailed down low vol. Now there's probably 45 products that do some twist on that to sort of, again, it's like soda flavors or whatever, and they serve it up in different ways. But SPLV was the first
one. How often does it change those 100 stocks that it holds?
It does it every quarter. So every quarter, it's going to rank the stocks, and it's going to take the 100 least volatile.
Right. Which can be tough because let's say utilities got creamed, right? You're going to have to take some down performance until that thing rebalances into wherever the next low vol is. That's why these things take a stomach.
Okay. I love these case studies. That really helped me figure out sort of how these products can perform. Nir, I'm going to come back to you because in addition to writing for Bloomberg Gadfly, you also touch other people's money.
Right, right. Well, in addition to writing for Bloomberg, I also run an asset management firm. So, you know, I manage money for other people. And I've always been a big believer in active management. I think that the evidence for certain types, there's a lot of quackery out there without question. But I think the evidence for the types of factors that we're talking about today, you know, value and some of the others, quality and momentum and so on, I think is well documented in the academic literature. And I think not controversial. Everyone agrees about it and so on. And so I've been sort of an early adopter of these smart beta funds just because they're active management more cheaply. So if you believe in active management and you should pay as little as possible for it. And so smart beta is perfect for that. The question is, okay, now you've got all these options. What do you do with them? Mm-hmm. And this is where it's early days and there's a lot of confusion about what to do. But what I would propose and what I actually do is I use them for simple diversification. It stands to reason that if you don't know which strategy is going to do well over the next period, then you just want to diversify across these strategies. In my opinion, it just makes sense to, instead of putting all your eggs in a market cap index or a value index or whatever, have exposure to various types of things. And these smart beta products allow you to do that relatively cheaply. And I think that's the first step on the bus. If investors take away anything from this podcast, in my opinion, what they ought to take is look at your portfolio, see what kind of exposures you have. If you have too much in one particular type or style of investing or factor, however you want to call it, then look at smart beta funds and diversify across them so that your eggs are in different baskets.
Which puts me back in a dark room touching an elephant. Tom, when you are on the other side of the table, how are you guys seeing investors use this, both from like a retail perspective, but also like the institutional?
Yeah, so I think it really comes down to now the ETFs that are coming out, they're trying to solve a problem, right? So it really comes down to what are you trying to solve? So are you using an active manager that maybe you're not happy with? Like you have a value manager. Maybe you might want to look at a value smart beta mm-hmm. ETF. Do you want to be in the market, but you want to be in the lowest vol product possible? So it's about talking to your clients or talking to investors and finding a problem. It's not just, you know, all the tools are now out there, right? The toolbox has gotten really big. It's just about figuring out what are you trying to accomplish. And that's the conversation we constantly have with clients, that this is the problem that I have. I want income, but I also want low vol income. So let's build a product that will give you, let's say, dividend paying stocks, but also with like a low vol component to it.
Solutions. We has them.
Exactly.
Hey, Joel here. Now that I'm the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, I pulled a few strings for our loyal podcast listeners. Go to businessweekmag.com/trillions right now for a 30-day free trial. If you like what we're doing here on Trillions, you're going to love the stories that we publish in Bloomberg Business Week. Here's that special offer one more time. Go to businessweekmag.com/trillions for your free 30-day trial. Thanks. Okay, last topic. What kind of due diligence should investors be doing before they pick up these tools?
Okay, I'll take a crack at this. So when I look at smart beta, again, we have this spectrum. And the way we determine where on the spectrum it goes, again, the more, quote, beta that is in it, the more it could just be a replacement. I think the more volatile it is, the more you could add it on as like a little bit of a hot sauce. But anyway, to determine what you're looking at, I would suggest a few things. One is the index weighting methodology. Does it weight by market cap?
Mm-hmm.
If so, it's probably going to be not that volatile, not that much exposure to any factor or anything, but you get a little. Is it weighted towards the factor itself? That's important. That's number one. Number two is the standard deviation, which it's a simple term. If you fell asleep in stats class like I did, I had to relearn it, but it's so useful. It's just basically looking at past volatility of this fund or stock or whatever. It could be used for anything. And just telling you how bumpy the ride will be. It's like almost like a ski slope line. Like, is this a black diamond or a blue square? So standard deviation is basically how bumpy the ride will be. But you need it relative to something. So I suggest taking the standard deviation of SPY or the S&P 500, which I believe right now might be around 9%. That means there's a two-thirds chance that the annual return of the S&P over the next year will be 9%. One way or the other, up or down. So where is it versus 9%? Mm-hmm. If it's 20%, you are going to have a real volatile smart beta product. If it's 9%, it's about the same. And there's some that are lower, like the low vol ETF might be more like 8%.
Mm-hmm.
So figure that out. That is huge because you don't want to buy something that's too spicy for you or too lame or doesn't move around enough. So I think those are two important stats. And then, of course, the fee. I think costs matter here. And now you can get a smart beta ETF for under 20 basis points. So you should shop around a little bit. Although when you're swinging for the fences, the fee isn't quite as important. But I think expense ratio is interesting because the range now is from 80 to 9. There's a big range and there's a lot of cost pressure going on in this space.
So, Nir, when R2-D2 with the head of Peter Lynch shows up at your door, what do you do?
Well, I think the I think as an investor, you want to look at if you look at nothing else, you want to look at what's the factor that I'm buying and how much am I paying for it. I think those are one and two. But if I can, let me just use the time I have for just a little bit of advocacy for this industry. I think there's something very important that we need to solve for, and I think we need to solve for it very quickly if smart beta is going to take off, and that is, we need to have some sort of labeling system to continue the analogy from earlier that tells you how much alcohol content is in the ETF, is in this factor. So in other words, if you're looking at five value factor ETFs, let's just say, you have no idea how much value is in one versus the other.
Mm.
And so as a consumer, you can't make it a smart decision about which one to buy. And so we need to come up with a standardized system to be able to say right there, almost like an expense ratio, like you know what it costs, right? So almost like an expense ratio that tells you this has this percentage of value in it. And we can do it in any, we can do it on a 10-point scale. We can do it on a 100% scale. We can do it in any way you want. But we have to do it, and there's a way to measure it. It would be very easy to do. The industry is going to push back against it because I don't think ultimately – I think they want this to be somewhat confusing because it's very difficult to differentiate if you make a lot of information available to investors. But I think we have to insist on it, and we have to give investors that tool so they can discriminate among the products.
Spoken like a true Bloomberg gadfly columnist. Tom, we set out to explore – the mystery of smart beta. Have we explored it?
I think it's going to be an ongoing debate, not just beyond this room, but it's going to be something that's going to keep evolving in the ETF industry because the lines are getting very blurry. Even the new players that are getting into the market, they're traditional active shops that are now launching ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's actively managed ETFs. The line's getting very blurry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just heard a lot of different takes on it, and it really depends on where you're coming from, and you may find smart beta is a solution to a boring core passive portfolio. You want a little spice in your life, or you may have too much spice and paying too much for this active manager so you think underperforming the mutual fund structure, and you want to basically lower your fees and make it a more clean, cheaper version of what you were getting before. So there's a lot of angles to this.
Yeah, I like the hot sauce. Hot sauce. Hot sauce is better than the elephant. All right, Nir Kesar, Tom Serafagas, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find Nir at Nir Kesar. And good luck spelling this one, but Tom's at T T. Serafagas. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Leedy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.